I like Chapter 4.
I like Chapter 4 too, and I think it was first, or was it the second one we did? Like, these panels are some of the first panels we did in the comic.
I like Chapter 4.
I like Chapter 4 too.
Chapter 4.
Chapter 4.
These panels are some of the first panels we did in the comic.
I always in my mind remembered them as the first, but I can't tell you for a fact if they were or not. I'd have to go through my email. It's all in there.
I don't want to spoil any of the future chapters, but I think that it could be the other story.
I was thinking it might have been the other story. Which is like, now that story begins at like chapter 19 or something.
Yeah,
like
it's way later.
I think it might be that.
Well, what's weird with that chapter is that the art style in it is more consistent with what we have later and earlier. I mean, it's more consistent in general with what we have. Yeah. While this chapter, at least Hester's face, had to be redone because the style changed a bit as we were working on it.
I don't know if I remember what it looked like before.
It's just tweaked a little bit. I think I'd made some color adjustment down the line as well as we were working.
Yeah, and you know what? This one has two, Chapter 4. I actually think this might have been the first, and I'll tell you why. No, it's not. It doesn't have to be. It's this chapter, the one that we're alluding to, that happens in like Chapter 19, and then one other one that happens even later. I think it's chapter 22 or 23 or something like that. And they were drawn smaller than some of the other, all of the other artwork.
Oh, like the panels were.
Yeah, like the resolution was lower.
Right.
And I remember.
Resolutions, yes.
Yeah, I remember because I'm looking at it so zoomed in all the time.
Yeah.
And the beginning, the first six panels of chapter 4, a bunch of that later chapter, that's 19. And it's actually a few chapters. And then the one that's towards the end of what we have completed. And so, it's not like it affects anything, but that's an interesting thing I think about the Evil Eye, is that the standard panel size that you've drawn is humongous.
Oh, yeah. They're like poster size, every single one of them. Yeah.
Yeah. We're in a really good situation if we ever need, like, a billboard, because you basically drew them at billboard resolution.
I figure, why not? And I think they're all, like, in 300 DPI as well, or maybe 600 DPI as well.
I think they might be six. They might be three, but they're, like, they're outrageous. The pixel count is, like,
I tend to go with 700.
7,000 something. Yeah, wide.
So
I like it.
But basically, since I drew them, I can tell when they're old and new, whenever we've mixed them in these chapters. So, for instance, to me, it's pretty obvious. It might be for readers as well.
Oh, well, of course.
When we go to the classroom scene.
It's probably only obvious to you, I bet.
I mean, when we go to the classroom scene, that those panels are drawn way later in the process. Yeah. They are probably 2 years apart, if not more.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I just remembered. You know the truck scene in chapter 4 where they're pouring like toxic ooze straight into the forest. Wet Hot American Summer, not the movie but the TV show, did the same thing. But I mean, we were before them.
Yeah, but we did it first.
They just didn't know it. Yes, because we hadn't published it, but. It kind of looks like we're stealing their idea. And when I saw that, I said to myself, damn, they beat us.
The funny nature of so much time elapsing on a project like this. I often do find little things that crop up that change how I'm thinking about our story. Because I'm like, shit, that's something that we got in there. We haven't put it out yet, but it's really similar. There's a few moments in Evil Life are... underwater koala story has a couple things here and there where I feel that way. In fact, there was a big movie last year that reminded me a lot of some parts of it. Although, I mean, you know, it can happen with any storyline that tackles the themes tackling there. And And in particular, in chapter 4 of The Evil Life, we see Hester getting bitten by the radioactive marmot, and then she goes to class, and something that's funny, this isn't the same as another story doing it, but we run into a situation there where even now the technology in the classroom is probably a little bit different than when we were envisioning it and when you were drawing it a few years ago. Because I bet everybody uses like tablets and their phones to take notes now, where everyone has a laptop in that.
Everyone has a laptop. That's true. I mean, one guy's on his phone, right?
Oh, like, yeah, true.
If you look at the classroom scene.
Right, right, right. That one sassy looking guy.
Yeah. Oddly enough, there were actually two people, but oddly somebody almost immediately caught the community reference in the background.
Oh, yeah, let's give a shout-out to that person. What was their username on
the list? The username is Pantsless Warrior.
Shout-out to Pantsless Warrior.
Yes. Pantsless Warrior says, glad to see the community gang still taking classes together. I was watching a ton of Community back when I was drawing this chapter, and Allison Brie is my favorite, and she was the inspiration for Hester's friend in this chapter. Oh. That is why her character isn't in the background, but actually the basis for Hester's friend.
Ah, very nice. Well, see, now,
I don't think I ever told you that.
Maybe you should have called her Allison.
No. To me, it's enough of a reference that I just sort of try to go with some level of similarity. The people in the background are way closer to their actual character designs.
But, I've never watched Community, but I even recognized a couple of them.
I was pretty into it back then. I haven't rewatched it since, but it definitely, like, whenever Allison Brie puts anything out, I immediately watch it. Like, I'm a fan of Glow as well.
That's cool.
So that's my community Easter egg.
Anyway. No, it's a good Easter egg.
Yep.
The Easter egg that I snuck in here, which is more just like it's not even like a proper Easter egg somebody would pick up on. And I think I did tweet about this, or maybe I even put it on Instagram too. I named the Allison character after my niece, who test read The Evil Life for me, I think, maybe before anybody else, at least before any, that I shared it with, one of the earliest people that I showed it to, read it, because she reads a lot of comics, and she's kind of in the age range that we had eventually settled on thinking could be getting into this, like the younger end of that.
And
I showed her this and our underwater koala comic at the same time, and she told me that she liked The Evil Life the most, and so I was like, oh man, I gotta name a character after her, and so that's why I called her Dini.
I did not know that Easter egg. That's so nice.
I don't know that I mentioned it to you. I think I probably just put it out there when we put the comic out.
And now your nephew is reading The Evil Life as well.
Oh yeah, so I was in London a couple weeks ago, and Teddy is his name. And he's 5 years old, and he's really into like anything with like a monster that's like a little bit grotesque. He's very like, you know, from your kids, you'll notice he's like half involved, half not involved. Like, he wants to know what you're doing, but he doesn't necessarily want to commit to knowing too much about what you're doing.
Oh yeah, you can't explain it too much.
Yeah, exactly. When he saw Hester's gross mouth in chapter 6, he was just like, aww. And he couldn't stop staring at it. So I went back and I read him chapters 4 and chapter 6, and I was so honored when he asked for a bedtime story that night. Basically, he just wanted me to retell him what he had read in those chapters with me. So that was really cool.
That is awesome. I love that. Radioactive Meep, right?
Yeah. Yeah, Radioactive Meat. Yeah. That's what he remembered. Because when we were reading it together, I would read the character dialogue, but I asked him to make the marmot noises.
Oh.
So I think that's why that really stuck in his mind.
Maybe I didn't explain that well if people are listening. I'm saying if people are listening, by the way, because, I mean, who knows? But Meep basically is what the sound that the marmots make as it's typed.
We had a bit of a journey into deciding that they would be marmots, didn't we? Kind of like evaluate a few different animals. I feel like we did, because...
Really?
Okay. So when I first had an inkling of what I thought the Evil Life could be, when it was super villainy back in the day,
Yeah.
I've spoken to my buddy Hank about seeing if he would be interested in working on a story like this together. And we had done Time Log together up to that point, which is,
right.
If anybody wants to check it out, you can download it on my website, where this podcast is. And we didn't really like hit the right stride together. And there was only one particular thing that I think we had discussed, which was making the Hester character, and I don't even know if she had that name yet, making her alter ego the Beaver.
Ah, yeah.
And we ditched that, and you and I don't even know if we ever even explored that route.
I don't think we discussed her being called the Beaver.
But was that one of the animals that we evaluated? I can't remember.
As I recall it, I think you just said, like, radioactive marmot. That was from the beginning.
I went there right away? Okay.
I think so. Because all I remember is I put a picture of a marmot up on the wall next to my desk, an actual picture of a marmot, as I was working on it. It was like my main reference picture to what marmots look like, and I just worked off of that, basically, doing her chapter.
Did you take a picture of your picture of a marmot? Because I would like to see that.
I could probably find it. It was from one of those... I had it as a kid. Like, you'd collect single pages every, I don't know, week, month, for like, this animal book, basically. It was like a binder, so you'd get one page every once in a while, and you'd add that to your book. And one of those animal pages, which could fold up, by the way, with more information on them in it, was a marmot page. So I just used that. And,
nice.
And I mean reference pictures on the internet as well, but that was the actual physical marmot picture I had. Oh.
I think maybe I was drawn to marmots because I really love Groundhog Day. Like, I just think it's a great, weird American holiday. And I didn't want to do groundhog because it just doesn't sound good to me. But marmots are basically like a more, I don't know what you, a worldly equivalent of a groundhog, right? Because they're in a few different places.
Yeah, and you'll find them in Europe as well, so people will be familiar with them. I mean, if it weren't for the movie Groundhog Day, I probably wouldn't even know of Groundhog Day, basically.
Yeah, understandably. Yeah. Well, you know, and this kind of leads me to an interesting train of thought. I think when we were developing this, we didn't necessarily want it to feel like you could say, oh, this is exactly where the story is set. We want it to feel a bit open.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what I mean.
Yeah. It's sort of like an international feel. But I kind of went for... So one of the things I considered whenever I drew something was, what does a power outlet look like? Should I go with a dotted power outlet or like these long vertical lines? I think I sort of went with like a North American standard. It's still ambiguous as to where the story takes place. And I think you could reasonably assume that it could just as well be Canada or the United States. But I sort of went with that, but not being too clear on where we're at. But I'm actually scrolling around. Look, they are long vertical lines. I've drawn North American power outlets in Bloom's lab.
Yeah, I feel like
look at me being specific and all.
That's good.
Yeah.
I feel like for the most part, like, I'm picturing it as a city I would maybe encounter, you know, this Megaville area that they're in. Here in the States, but we also do keep it relatively ambiguous. Because I want it to feel like, it might not be exactly like where you are to anybody who's reading this out there in the world, but it's not so specific that you feel like it's definitely not where you are. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that's sort of in the vein with superhero comics in general, that you're not really, like, that's why they build Metropolis or Gotham or whatever city you want, because they don't want to use a specific, I mean, unless we're talking Marvel, early superhero comics didn't want to use specific cities. And we're sort of, if anything, it's sort of like a tribute to that.
I think it definitely is. How much did we get into that conversation? Do you remember? It feels so long ago.
If Not at all, I think. No, you know what? I think you actually mentioned something about, like, not being too clear on it, but I don't think we discussed it more than that, I think. Man, that was so long ago. That's, like, early art direction kind of stuff. Yeah.
The way I love chapter four, but it was actually two separate chapters when we had thought of it. Hester's stuff in there was one of the earliest things that we came up with for her. And then the classroom stuff happened later, I think, as a necessity for bridging the gap between maybe some other ideas that we had to kind of get her from being bitten by this marmot and changing all the way towards when we see her transformed. And I do think that, like, I feel like, in particular, with this character of Hester Herman, that undoubtedly in this first, you know, quote-unquote volume, Growing Evil, of the comic, there's more of her than anybody else. The chapters basically alternate her and other characters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've hardly met Blarg yet.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But he's up next, so
we're about to... Yeah, he is. He is. And I think... So you're listening to this, and so you'll know who the baby alien is by the time you watch by the time you read chapter 7 that comes out after this, a little bit more at least.
Yeah.
But I think for us it felt easy to use Hester as a place to bridge the gap, but also like this wasn't like a planned story. We just at times we would decide, oh, maybe we should do another, you know, a short scene with Hester Herman, because it just feels like something we want to do. So it just kind of evolved that there's more development, more backstory for her.
Definitely, because we always went back to Hester discussing, like, well, we haven't explored this aspect, or we haven't explored that aspect. And eventually that's sort of why she got a lot of chapters, and she's in a lot of them as well. But in a lot of ways, this is going ahead of time, by the way, because we're still on the early chapters. But in a lot of ways, she's sort of the glue of the story.
And, I think so.
And that's why she gets a lot of exposure as well, not only early, but also later on.
Yeah, but I do feel like as we get later, some of these chapters we were alluding to, chapter 19, you know, and all that, she definitely is not in the focus consistently. We do get big chunks of time when our other characters are really the driving
absolutely
force. But it's fun. I think about it a lot, how we sort of accidentally, or at least eventually, found a way to weave these three characters together, and I hope everybody really enjoys seeing how we did it, because I know that I've enjoyed the journey of doing it, just, you know, in terms of imagining their world and their lives and stuff. It's been really fun for me to see how.
And them together is, that's where the story is at its best.
I think so.
But chapter 5 isn't bad. It's one of my favorite in terms of art.
Well, you really killed it with the astral plane stuff. I mean, it looks so fucking cool.
So what I did with the astral plane scene is that I went with no black ink whenever they're in the astral plane.
That makes sense.
That's one of the choices I went with, because I figured, I mean, the mom has like dark blue line work and the dad has gray and brown line work to make it feel like more floaty, less anchored in reality. I also let their astral selves sort of be a projection of how far along they are with their magic abilities. So you'll notice how Gloom is sort of, he doesn't have arms, he just has floating hands, and how he's sort of breaking apart constantly, because his astral form isn't really fully formed. Also one of those, like, just small details. And he's kind of small. Like, his dad has to shrink in size in order to have, like, a normal conversation with his son. Just stuff like that. Because his parents are so much more powerful in terms of their use of magic.
That's really cool. I don't know that you and I ever discussed all of those specifics into the way that
those are just like things that I felt belonged in the astral plane, because everything's supposed to... Oh, and their mouths move as well. Like, their masks aren't stale anymore.
Right.
They can actually make facial expressions, and which was always a challenge with Gloom. Like, how do you make a guy with a mask express emotion. Well, you basically have those little glowing dots for eyes and angles, of course.
Yeah.
But here in the astral plane, I could just go wild with it. And when he gets upset towards the end, I know I'm blabbering on, but when he...
No, I love this. Please.
When he gets upset towards the end, he starts to break apart. Like, stuff, parts of his astral form are just shattering before he fades away because he cannot control his astral form as well when he's angry. So the crown's breaking apart, his shoulder armor parts are falling apart as well. Just those simple little details that reveal a lot about him as a character and his disinterest in magic in general. There's that, and I also went with the classic like chakras as well. You'll notice like small dots, one above his crown, and the one in the middle of his forehead and one on his body. So you have the zoomed out view where you can see his dad in the background. The first astral plane panel, you'll also see that he has dots beneath him because those should be part of his astral form, but he cannot form legs. But he still has like a full chakra, like all parts of it.
That's really good.
I mean, the top chakra, the one that's supposed to be above the head, is part of the dad's crown as well as the mom's crown because they are fully formed. So I went with sort of like, Indian mythology or Buddhism, or I think they both have the same concept of chakras, but I might be wrong on that. But I went with that type of spiritualism for the design of this area. And dinosaurs in the background because that's cool. Also,
I love it. Yeah, I love all the stuff floating in the background. It's really good. Yeah, it's like anything could potentially exist in this astral plane, which is chef's kiss. I love it. Yeah, that's really brilliant. I love the way that you thought through this. And that, to me, is probably my favorite. Maybe it's my second favorite thing about telling stories with you. I love all of the depth that you add into a panel that you can just feel it if you want to read it, but learning about the layers, to me, that adds another thing that you can be thinking about when you read it. So I hope some of our listeners who are hearing us discuss this, if you have already read the comic, maybe go back and read it again. I would recommend reading it here on my website, nickmarino.net, in particular, because you get the full width of the panel as opposed to the webtoon ones that have been cropped a bit. So they're readable on phones and stuff. And if you read it on my site here, you'll really see, and you can really get pretty, the images are relatively high res that are there. So if you click on the picture and you scroll through with your arrows or with swiping, you'll really get to see the detail that Niels has added to all of the astral plane panels. I love them. Looking at that art, it's very like, I love your color choices in there. I love the aesthetic choices. I could go wild.
I basically felt like I'll just go wild with colors, like whatever I want. Like I wanted a space background, but I didn't want a black background. I went space with color.
Well, it's really effective, and it's kind of sad to think that we're not going to see the king and queen again, I don't think, for a while. At least in the thing that we've completed, right?
No, because we're working on the other story. That's true. Yeah. I really like the king and queen. And,
oh, me too.
One of my favorite panels in this one is actually the mom's art studio, the queen's art studio.
Oh, I love it so much.
I don't want to give too much away, but she does paint the future and the past. And the painting she's got that she's working on at the moment is sort of alluding to the stuff that Gloom's working on in his lab. Because you'll notice that the tentacle thingies have small eyes.
Yeah, that one I didn't put together.
Yeah, and you have, it's probably Earth and how those things are consuming the planet. Like, that could, like, it's sort of alluding to, it's not something we discussed or anything. It doesn't even have to come true. No. I just wanted to throw in, like, an Easter egg that's a possible future, that whatever he's working on at that specific moment starts to grow. And I have planted those squishy pink thingies in other places as well. Because they do multiply and they grow. But really, the reason I added them to this chapter was to reveal passage of time. So when the thing first blows up, he has some goo on him. But at the end of the chapter, he has a lot of it. They've grown, they're bigger, they seem more sentient. Yep, it kind of looks like one's trying to eat him.
Right, yeah. Right. And there's like, I'm thinking maybe three faces by the time we get to the end.
So, he's not really bothered by it. He's like, he's too bothered by the fact that he has to get a job. But I kind of like, it was at the moment, it was all about just showing passage of time. Like these things have grown. So he's been in the astral plane for a while at least. But I also sort of wanted to leave the door open for one of his experiments coming back and possibly just being a minor problem, which is why I threw it into the background. I just went with it. And then
You're telling me now, and it's not too late. So
that's true. That's true.
Yeah. No, I actually had some ideas that I really some ideas that I like that I think thinking about what we've discussed could potentially happen beyond what's been completed.
Yeah.
I see the perfect opening for our pink squishy friends. But that's for another time.
Yep. And we have from time to time discussed how the story would continue. And we even did some concept stuff on like future chapters and what would happen. Like I remember we had sort of a basic grasp of the first chapter of the next part of the story.
Yeah, did I ever send you? I wrote this, I feel like maybe 6 months ago, I wrote this big outline for what, in my mind, I feel like I did send it to you. Could make a nice.
Because you sent me some stuff about some characters you wanted for that. And we did concept those characters.
Right. Oh, God, I feel like that was forever ago.
And
then,
it was.
But then recently I thought about it some more. Well, I'll have to go back through and check, but I do actually have a pretty detailed outline of what I think could be good. But obviously, it's all about what we think could be good, not just about what I think could be good.
We could get back to that. But I was a bigger part of. I know we discussed this in the last episode, but I was a bigger part of the writing process on this one. But I enjoy so much getting just scripts from you when we're working on the current project that I might want to do that as well with this if we ever were to return to this project. But I'd still probably like, I'd still throw stuff into the background because that's just fun.
Well, it's important to me, whatever we're doing,
that
the way we're doing it is your preferred way of doing it.
Really? Because I'm totally open. If you wanted more input, you definitely get it. But
No. I feel like, you know what is really, we're so lucky is that there's a lot of conversations we've never had or we've never had to have. Just kind of work and it works.
There's like zero friction. We're just we're just showing stuff out there.
Yeah, we're very lucky.
Yeah. Yeah.
We haven't had a lot of conversations about do we need to be doing this or that to make it better. We just kind of do it, and it's slow, and that I feel like that's mostly me, but it happens.
I think what we have in common is we love saying yes to everything, so we're just like, oh, that's a great idea, let's do that, and then the other guys, yeah, and we'll just. I think that's what's constantly happening, that we're just excited about working with this, and then stuff gets done.
Yeah. No, you're right. And that is actually a philosophy. And it's much easier doing that when I'm working with you than it is with other people. But that's a philosophy I do really try to embrace, which is when I'm collaborating on a story, I want to work in whatever. I want to be able to say yes as much as possible to any idea that comes across my plate. I do know, though, I did let you down on our underwater koala story. I think about this all the time.
No.
Yeah. What do you mean? You told me you thought we needed to add in a groveling character, and I haven't done it.
I don't remember a groveling character, really? I don't even remember that.
I think about it like every week. I'll be writing it. I'll be like, I never put in Neil's groveling character.
Really? Because I've suggested like 20 or 30 characters. Like we have a roster of it could not have been that important because have like good. We have a backlog of characters for that.
You know, we have so many that we haven't even gotten a chance to use yet. I think I did have to cut another one recently, actually.
Due to space. But that was the point. I just drew random weird characters, and you got, and whenever you felt like one of those fit, we'd use it. But, and I mean, the one in issue 7. You know, we shouldn't talk about that now. But you just recently in the chapter I'm working on right now, you've used one of the weirdest ones. You know what?
Oh yeah, I remember the one. Yeah. The story you're working on now.
The one the one with the club. It's one of the weirdest ones. I never thought we'd use that, but it's definitely going to be fun seeing that character on page.
Yeah, basically who I cut is the who would have been one of the other ones from the many. There was one that we were potentially going to include in our culminating chapter that came after that, but there's so many threads to wrap up. And it's funny because I think about how we didn't have a map for doing the evil life, and we just kind of let the characters kind of lead us along, and we would say, oh, maybe we need to fill in this blank. But our underwater koala story, we're doing that so differently. There's, at least for me, it feels like there's much more of a, I might not know exactly how everything needs to come together, but all of this stuff needs to come together, and this is exactly how many pages you have left.
Yeah.
And I'm on those last 20 pages now, and it's tricky. It is so tricky.
But I mean, if you ever felt you needed 10 more pages, that's really not a problem.
No, I know we could. I know we could. We could. I'm like, I'm committed.
Yeah, I know you are.
And it's going to work. It's really good. I think I got it now. It's just, you know, the groveling character didn't make it in. I've had a lot of unnecessary guilt about that.
Apparently so, yeah.
We'll save them for the future. Somewhere else we'll have a groveling character.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's always room for a character like that later on. But yeah, that's sort of been my main contribution to that series. I mean, besides drawing it, I mean, in terms of writing, I've just thrown concepts out there. Like, there are a ton of monsters we haven't used.
That's right. Yeah, we do have all the unused monsters.
We have a bunch of different monsters, like from different kinds of places, and they're weird, all of them. And
podcast recording session has given me so many good ideas for places to use all these things that we haven't used yet. Yeah, I know exactly where to use them now too. If we find ourselves with that opportunity. Sorry, was that really loud? There are people driving like.
I heard a car, but
yeah, it was so loud. My street, it's next to the beach, so people are always like driving some weird fast thing by my apartment.
I want to send you like a bunch of the old sketches now just to ask what you think about them, but we're sort of getting off topic and stuff we can't really discuss on a podcast as well.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because if we want to use that stuff.
Yeah.
No,
but you know what? I'm not like trying to sound like a broken record here, but you know, our collaboration takes up a lot of, it's taken up many years, and it takes up a lot of time and stuff like that. So I think about these things a lot. And for me, I think part of why it's been so much fun to keep it going and it's continued on its own so easily is because I think we appreciate the different things that each other brings to the process. And for me, you are always doing writing, even if it's not in a script, because the details you put into the background, like you did in the astral plane, and even just little, even mannerisms, those choices you're making, those are storytelling choices. And to me, they bring out the best in the story. I feel like I'm just providing a suggestion for something that I think could be cool until all of those expressions and mannerisms and settings come together in the art. And then to me, it really feels like that's a full story.
Well, I get what you're going for here, because it's sort of, I think the way I see it is, and I think we've discussed this before as well, and I don't remember, it's not my, I don't remember where I heard it first, but I know some comic artist once said that you should be able to read a comic without any word balloons at all, and I sort of took that to heart. So
oh, you really did. here with Evil Life, unquestionably.
So whenever I try to do a panel, I try to think of not only, as you said, mannerisms, absolutely, but I sort of try to tell, like, convey characters' personalities by the way they organize their room. Like,
yeah.
Gloom is kind of a slob in the background. He's a genius, but he's also really disorganized. He cannot... And when we see his room in the earlier chapter, when he's younger, we get sort of a hint. We get slight hints. Like, he is kind of a science geek, and he's all over the place. He likes everything. And I sort of... Or Gloom's dad, since he can't express anything with his mask, instead his magic sort of speaks its own language. Now, I know I'm going back a couple of chapters, but his magic orbs that he has on his shoulders sort of show symbols of what he's trying to say. Also one of those waves of, you can even sort of see when he rolls out the scroll, if you're on chapter two, you can even see like a hint of masks, I think. Yeah, like small masks of his ancestry or something like that, because he's thinking back to the olden days or prophecy or whatever, like his lineage. So it's kind of that as well.
It definitely is, and I remember when I tasked myself with, okay, I got to go back through, evaluate everything, and do a second pass on these scripts before it came down to lettering. I just had a file that was 400 whatever panels that you'd drawn, and I showed it to a few people, and always the answer for them was like, oh, wow, like I see the story. There were a couple maybe jokes that weren't obvious because, you know, you had to have the verbal component to, like, you know, but the character development, the flow, the way that these three characters kind of come together eventually, all of that is very clear within your storytelling. And I like to think that makes it a very rich and strong reading experience.
Thank you. I mean, I really appreciate that you appreciate it so much because that is... And I just shout out to Jake DNNY Danny, Jake Danny, I guess. On Webtoons wrote "Nice Roommate" because he liked Gloom's room. He appreciated.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out to that guy, because it does have a ton of storytelling in it.
It really does. In itself.
And the fact that he's at some point he must have insisted on the fact that he wanted like this boxed, walled in, tiny teenagers type of room in this what seems to be like a gigantic hallway with like stone statues in it, and it's just one of those things. I really appreciate whenever people notice like background stuff. I'm always looking for comments. Like, what I enjoy the most is seeing if people catch any of the Easter eggs that I put in there, but I'm always sort of glad when someone hasn't as well, because then I know there's something left to discover as well.
Yeah, see, that's cool. I think that makes it really fun. I mean, in a perfect world, I would love to one day see the story printed where every page of the book is just the panel, you know, really big.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it would be thick. It would be kind of a crazy looking book. But to me, that would be the ideal reading experience is, you know, if you can just breeze through it if you want, but you can take time and you can look into the background and you can notice little things bubbling and coming back and getting referenced again and stuff that's not explicitly brought to your attention just through the course of the narrative. You know, it's just details that bring it to
absolutely
life. But I guess that's kind of really something that neither of us anticipated getting into this, but that really kept us going with this story so long, is that you know, it's almost like akin to role playing or something like that. It's just you end up with a story afterwards, right?
I mean,
because there's so much world building.
Exactly. And just like role-playing, it kind of has that natural flow to it as well. It's a collaborative process. Nobody's really in charge of the story.
Yeah.
It sort of takes on a life of its own and just ends up someplace. Man, I'm actually noticing like a ton of detail
Oh, I'm sure there's so many things that you've forgotten over the years.
Yeah, I've forgotten a ton of stuff. Like Hester's, chapter four, Hester's coffee cup says Mega Hot, and they're in Megaville. I don't even know if that's a connection, or if we called it Megaville back then, or
we did from the beginning. I think we did because our first collaboration, that Super Hater story.
Yeah,
I had never named where the Super Haters lived except for in that story, and I chose to name it because it was supposed to be Super Haters the movie.
Yeah.
And so I thought to myself, well, why don't we at least give them a place that sounds like a fictional city in a superhero story? And then when it came to the Evil Life, I just sort of felt like, well, we did one story with the city name. What if somewhere else in that city all this other stuff is happening? You know, so then it's gone from Super Haters to Evil Life. And then it even showed up in Cougar and Cub.
Yes. And I
by Daniel LaRuta Massa and I.
Yes. And it even has like a big baby, and I don't want to say too much.
Oh, I know. I think about that all the time because that's been my background on my iPad for years. Yes,
because there's a big baby in both of them, like a giant baby, and it's in the same city. It's just perfect.
And that was just the accident. I mean, it's not like you.
Oh, yeah. I remember I emailed you and it was like Cougar and Cub. That was, is that the same baby? And you were like, yeah, now it is.
You want to know something funny?
Yeah.
I had not seen that Cougar and Cub book, the collected printed version of it, until I was in London a couple weeks ago.
Wait, they didn't just give you a copy?
No. I swore earlier in the podcast, but I realized since it's an all-ages comic, maybe I shouldn't swear too much. Those POSs at that publisher. They changed their policy, so I have to pay them to get my comp copies.
Wow.
Yeah. Wait, so it would have cost me like $36 to get 5 copies of it.
That's
or something insane. And I'm at this point, it's just principle. I hate them so much that I just decided no, I'm not going to do it. And I've been waiting for an opportunity to get a really inexpensive version of it. I feel like whatever I do, it has to be less than the $7 a copy they wanted me to pay for those.
Well, I mean, I paid full price, and you don't really want to know what comics cost in Sweden.
I know, I'm sure they're so expensive.
But I'm sure they get like not like the regular cut, because there's probably like a, or who knows, maybe they import it, maybe there's a printing publisher here who takes on.
It's definitely just, I know they only did a short print run of that book. It was printed in China, shipped to the United States, and then would be shipped from Diamond USA to Diamond Europe or wherever the distributor is.
Every time it changes hands, someone else gets a cut. So hopefully profits from Europe are less than they are from the United States in this case.
Well, I certainly don't see any of it, but I'm waiting. I'm going to talk to a retailer at some point and find out if they're ever on liquidation, and then just buy up whatever stock I can get of that book. Because they must have a decent, unless the publisher, now who shall not be named, might have already taken them back into their. I don't know what happened to it. I disavowed them after they sent me some incredibly rude emails. I just stopped responding to them.
Well, your thoughts on the publisher aside, if you can get your hands on a copy, I guess used, do so, because Cougar and Cub is an amazing comic. I am, however, a bigger fan of Holy, and since this is an all ages podcast, Holy F asterisk CK.
Holy fudge, as one moderator would call it when I did
pay. Yeah. Holy fudge. 1 and 2.
Thanks. We had so much fun doing that story. Yeah.
Yes. It has one of the funniest panels in comic history, in my opinion.
Oh, what is it? I want to know which one it is.
It is that, but I'd be spoiling it, wouldn't I? I mean, it's the reveal. It's that there's this shocking, it's at a hospital.
Oh, yeah.
You know which one I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know the one. We had a lot of fun with that one, yeah.
It's not every day you unexpected. Laugh out loud. It is not every day you uncontrollably laugh out loud when you read a comic, and that was one of those instances. It was definitely, I was not expecting that. Like,
thanks. That was the idea. Yeah, you know,
you show a lot. It was complete shock value, but still, it was great.
Well, that's, you know, yeah. I feel like I feel very fortunate because it's rare to have more than one collaborator, I feel like, where you really get each other. And I felt like Daniel Arutamasa with that story, he really understood. I didn't get very explicit in that. I prefer, in particular, like with stuff like that, that's like a more like graphic or whatever, or like mature reader stuff. Mm-hmm. I like to let my collaborator draw what they're comfortable with. Mm-hmm. So with Daniel, I think, you know, we wrote it in there. I think we both liked the joke and we knew it was going to be in there. I think, I don't know, I can't remember honestly.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was his choice to go all out on that one. And I think it's a funny joke.
He made the right choice. It was just, man, you guys did an amazing job on that story. It was just great.
I'm trying to channel, because with that one, I knew by the time I was wrapping up work on that second volume, I knew we weren't going to be doing any more of that just because that publisher was already really starting to grind my gears at that point. And so I'm trying to channel. I feel like that story wraps up really nicely in the second volume of Holy Fudge. So I'm trying to channel that right now to wrap up our underwater koalas. I'm like, I just got to get to that point. It doesn't have to feel like, I want it to feel like their story can go on. But when somebody reads it, they get to that page 160, they're going to feel like, damn, that all came together. I want somebody to have that feeling, because when you don't stick the landing with the ending, that's so unsatisfying.
Yeah, I've actually been putting off reading the last few volumes of The Walking Dead because I'm so worried that they won't stick. I mean, it's 32 volumes long. I'm really terrified that. I mean, I love Robert Kirkman, but I'm worried he's not going to stick the landing on this one because it's such a long run.
I mean, we're going to find out at the end of this year if they stick the landing with episode 9.
Yeah, and I'm kind of worried after the last trailer. It doesn't look.
I'm not feeling it.
I am not feeling the latest trailer, no. I mean, the Mandalorian trailer nailed it. It was
okay.
I'm really stoked about the Mandalorian, but the latest trailer, I think they're showing a lot. And and you know, with Disney, sometimes they show stuff that's really not that important for the movie. They try to trick us as an audience.
They do pretty good with that, yeah.
They do, but at the same time, I mean, even so, I wasn't a huge fan of episode 8, by the way. So I'm definitely one of those people looking forward to them going back and sort of, I wouldn't say fixing episode 8, but at least explaining some of the things episode 8 was trying to do, because it was kind of vague and kind of open with what it was doing. And depending on what episode 9 does, episode 8 could actually be a great movie.
Okay. I see what you're saying. No, I understand. I have different feelings because Star Wars is, it's hard to avoid it. Although I know a few people who have. But for me, it was never something I considered myself like in the fandom of Star Wars until, this is going to sound weird, but until this new trilogy, I really wasn't that deep into it. It was just some movies I saw, you know? But 7 and 8 for me have been very much like, I've enjoyed both of them a lot. And it's interesting talking to people who have been maybe more involved with it for their lives, you know? And I know that you've always been a very big Star Wars fan.
Absolutely. Like ever since I was a kid. And I'm definitely the wrong generation because there weren't any real good Star Wars toys when I was growing up, at least not in Sweden, because I mean, when I was a kid, we were sort of in between movies.
'90s were a dead zone for the toys, as far as I remember.
Like, I still remember, like, rolling paper around flashlights and stuff, trying to build my own lightsabers, trying to make my own Star Wars toys.
We didn't have any of that stuff. No. That is an interesting thing. I had one friend, I cannot remember his name for the life of me. Kyle, I think it was, actually. I think I'm remembering his name. And his older brother had given him a suitcase of the, was it Kenner? Isn't that who did the original?
Yeah, yeah, Star the original run of Star Wars 3.5 inch, 3 3/4 inch figures was Kenner, yeah.
Yeah, and he had a suitcase full of them, old dirty ones that, you know, his brother must have been a kid in the early 80s or something like that. And, and he and Kyle had those, and I remember we played with them once and seeing them, and I was like, huh, I wonder why it's hard to get these now. How come these aren't really around? Because the movies are so easy to watch, but the toys were not easy to find. And we did get, we got a trickle of stuff, mostly because of all the EU content and stuff like that. But really, it wasn't until, what, 99 that it really kind of got to the level where it is now.
With episode one, in 99, they started making new Star Wars toys. And they were also going back making the old characters. So, and that's around the time, I'm not sure when Hasbro bought up Kenner or bought the license, but I think it was sometime in the 90s when they started making Star Wars toys.
I think it was, because I watched that Netflix, that episode of The Toys That Made Us.
Oh, yes, The Toys That Made Us.
That was a good one. And it's in the 90s at some point.
Yeah. And that's when we really started seeing Star Wars toys popping up again. But fortunately, I was like 13 around that time and wasn't that into buying Star Wars toys anymore. But I did make like one of those lame lightsaber fighting action movies where I edited lightsaber effects on sticks and stuff like that with a couple of friends. Because I was still totally into Star Wars, even though I was like, I might have been older. I might have been like 16 when I made that one. But still, I was still totally into Star Wars stuff, but I did not buy any of the toys. And then the Lego Star Wars stuff started coming out, and I was like, damn, I am definitely born in the wrong generation. Like a gap. Star Wars, yeah. What's funny is I'm actually born on Star Wars Day. Fun fact. Yeah. May the 4th be with you. Just a fun fact.
What's funny? Before we started recording, there was some stuff that reiterated to me how odd it is that we've known each other for so long and worked together so much. And I didn't know certain things about your life. And this is reminding me that again, because I don't think I knew that. I don't know if I'm not a very public birthday person, but I don't know if we've ever spoken to each other about our birthdays.
On Facebook, I haven't made my birthday public.
No, mine's private. I don't want people to wish me a happy birthday. Maybe that sounds weird. I just don't.
No. Me too. Because I know a lot of people feel it's nice, but after a couple of years of these constant birthday wishes back and forth, and I always felt obliged to wish people happy birthday back as well.
Right.
Eventually, and it felt dishonest. Especially if someone I sort of only half know, eventually I just felt like I should just remove my birthday from Facebook and just not get into this whole birthday thing. Plus, I'm in my 30s. Who celebrates? I mean, you can still celebrate your birthday, but I mean, it's not a big deal in the same way as it was when you're a kid.
This is actually like a major problem in my life, which is that I don't hold birthdays very sacred, but a lot of other people. That's for them. That's like a very special moment in the year for them. So I do often find myself at odds whenever there's an important birthday coming up with somebody in my life. And I'm like, shit, what do I do? Because I really don't give a crap about a birthday. But, you know, there are certain times when you gotta interact with the birthday. So there's something I feel like, you know, I'm still learning.
Like, I think Patton Oswalt, you know, the stand-up comic, I think he had a bit about that. Like, we should only celebrate people when you hit an even number, like 30s, 40s, 50s, like save them for every 10 years or so, the big ones, and then just don't have a party, like eat a cake.
Yeah.
But that, I sort of agree with that. What's good about my birthday being on Star Wars Day is actually, since it's my birthday, I get to decide how we celebrate it, and I always celebrate Star Wars Day instead, because I don't really care about my birthday. But I do like Star Wars, which means that I get to decide that we watch a Star Wars movie. And I have a tradition where I like building lightsabers. But this year I didn't build one for myself. Instead, I built these plastic pipes for wiring. And I painted them in red, blue, and green and stuff and printed out with a 3D printer, like different saber hilt parts. Yeah. And all the kids in the neighborhood got to build their own lightsaber. We built like 10 plus, like 12 lightsaber, and just had like a huge lightsaber fight. It was a ton of fun. Like that kind of stuff. And I get to make up what celebrating Star Wars Day means because it's my birthday. So, like, celebrating Star Wars Day is building stuff and watching movies.
That's great. So
yeah, and I always try to ramp it up every year, but I sort of hit my limit for how big I can make Star Wars Day without finding Star Wars Day collaborators, I guess, because at the moment I'm just prepping everything and trying to make it fun for the kids as well.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
That's really cool, though. That sounds like it was definitely a good birthday.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. This is a podcast about webcomics, right?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I knew that.
Since we're on Star Wars anyway, I'm not going to say that I actually hate Episode 8. And I get why people like it.
Yeah.
But the major gripe is that it narratively takes like a hard left turn.
Yeah, there's a lot of deviations in there, which is probably why it works for me, because the deviations to me are at this point kind of like exciting for me.
Sure, and they could be, and that's sort of what makes 9 important. 9 decides if 8 was good or not, because that left turn could be catastrophic or it could be great.
Yeah.
Why I think a lot of people don't like Star Wars Episode 8 is because Star Wars is not really about there are some reveals, like who's Luke Skywalker's father, but all in all, it's not that much about surprises in general, and it's a saga. It's like a classic story. It's built up. It's narratively built upon these classic myths. It's almost like comfort food, really. We follow characters on an adventure, and the adventure is exciting, and we have cool effects, and that's all it really has to be. Now they're trying to do something more with it, which is in of itself, of course, interesting, but it runs the risk of taking away that core feeling of classic storytelling that Star Wars has always had, at least with the original trilogy. And I think that's what people are mainly turning against, or at the very least are concerned about, that Episode 9 will have a disconnect with the rest of the story thanks to the path that Episode 8 has taken.
Yeah.
But I mean, remains to be seen.
I understand what you're saying. I've seen a wide range of reactions to it in terms of people who didn't connect with Episode 8. And some people I do really feel like they just got some issues with the way that they view things in life. You know, there are some people who, whether they want to admit it or not, had some, let's say, prejudiced inclinations for the way that they interpreted the story and what they didn't like about it. But talking to you about this, talking to my brother-in-law about it, who's a lifelong Star Wars fan that didn't connect with it, and other people have definitely made me look at the story in a different way. And it's pretty amazing to have something that communally so many of us watch, but that has the depth to it that we can sort of pick it apart, and the nuances in it become sticking points in conversations that get deeper about what does and doesn't work in a story.
Exactly. And what actually makes a Star Wars story.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I find that very interesting. And those are the kind of things that I guess we instinctively consider when we're telling our own stories, you know. Yeah. Evil Life doesn't have, I don't think it has too much in common with a Star Wars-esque story, although maybe our underwater koalas have some more commonalities, maybe just because it's a bit bigger in terms of action and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah,
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I can see how they definitely found themselves with some odd problems in designing these new Star Wars stories. Because there are so many things that, for example, you and I, we've never considered going into our stories that were just kind of like, we were just feeling them out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of that weird scenario with George Lucas where he was just feeling out a lot of things and nobody necessarily needed to have answers to questions that people 20 years find themselves asking later, you know, and now 40 years later asking.
What was Boba Fett like when he was a kid?
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Rosie, my wife, she, you know that, but I mean, for people listening, she's an entertainment journalist. And we were just talking about when she was writing up The Mandalorian, a piece about The Mandalorian for Hollywood Reporter. We were talking about a lot of stuff about that clearly nobody ever thought twice about, but because they spent so much time expanding the lore of what it means to be from Mandalore and to be a bounty hunter mm-hmm. in that world. Now it has a whole completely different implication, whereas before, Boba Fett just appeared first in the Star Wars holiday special as just like like a cool design, you know? I mean, I'm sure they knew that he was going to be in Empire Strikes Back at that point, but still.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they had like these previews where journalists got to go to Industrial Lights and Magic and have like a interview the makers of the costume, stuff like that. I mean, they'd show parts of, they sort of tried hyping him up even before the movie. I think the toys were out even.
Oh, yeah, the toys might have been out. Yeah, by that point. Yeah.
But yeah, it's such a cultural phenomenon and so culturally significant as well. Like, a few films have been referenced to the extent that Star Wars has, and it's definitely important that they nail this last one. I think sort of what's going on as well is that people are conflicted whether or not Star Wars is a Skywalker story or not.
Right.
Like, episode 1 to 6 were all Skywalker stories. Then 7 was sort of vague on that, on the subject. I mean, we know that Ben Solo is technically a Skywalker through his mom, but yeah. If it's... And up until 7, that didn't really matter. But then they started making these other Star Wars story movies, like Rogue One and the Han Solo movie, and all of a sudden... Instead of just having, before, a Star Wars movie only had to take place in the Star Wars universe, and then technically it's a Star Wars movie. And then you could call it episode 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But as soon as you break off from that formula and you have non-numbered movies, you sort of have to go back to the numbered ones and define them. Like, okay, so what makes these numbered movies and these others non-numbered sequential movies? They're all sequential, but non-numbered. And at that point, after they released Rogue One, people started looking at Episode 8 as though it should probably be a Star Wars story about Skywalkers because that is what's missing from Rogue One. So Star Wars was sort of defined by what it wasn't in Rogue One, sort of.
That's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. Do you like Rogue One?
I thought it was fine. It's the first half is a little messy in terms of storytelling, but visually it's great. I think some characters were probably supposed to be more fleshed out, but they weren't. But all in all, yeah, it's a fun action movie. But I mean, it's not one of my favorites, but I'll watch it from time to time. I even thought Solo was fine. I miss Harrison Ford being in it, obviously.
It definitely feels weird without him.
It feels weird because he is... If I sort of try to suppress any notion that I'm supposed to be watching a Han Solo movie and I'm just watching like a Rogue movie set in the Star Wars universe, then it works. And his relationship to Chewbacca is still really good. And Donald Glover does an amazing job playing Lando Calrissian. So there are a lot of good things with that movie. But also not one of my favorites. But what happened with Episode 8, I think the big thing was when they tell Rey that she comes from nothing. Basically, they're saying, well, you're not a Skywalker. Which she at that point almost had to be story-wise, even though it's obvious and kind of almost pedestrian, I guess, her being that. It's not that creative, but still, at that point, since Rogue One was released and sort of defined what a non-numbered Star Wars movie is, she sort of had to be a Skywalker. Because now what is Episode 8? Why is not the Mandalorian series Episode 6.5? That's sort of the point we're at right now.
I see what you're saying. That's interesting. I hadn't considered those angles on it in that way. And that is one of the things I've really enjoyed about this movie being a bit contentious, is that it's definitely like there are some things that are almost unwritten, I think, in fandoms that you don't necessarily know if you feel like something is breaking the rules until you encounter it, you know?
Yeah.
That's very interesting stuff.
And
go ahead.
I think their solution to the problem is probably making the whole Star Wars story possibly an Emperor story since he's returning. Because he's a character that's been along for the ride, sometimes in the background, sometimes a featured character. But he's always along for the ride, behind the scenes, manipulating things. You could call it an Emperor story, that is what the Star War is, his war. That would sort of fix it, and they have alluded to the Emperor returning. I mean, we hear his voice, he's in the poster. That could be part of it. But I'm not sure. That might solve it as well. It doesn't really reveal why Rey is a part of the story, though. That is still kind of a mystery. Like, she doesn't have to be a Skywalker, obviously. But narratively, what is her function for the story? In what way does the story wrap up with her? This 9-movie-long story, why does it end? I love Rey, by the way. I'm not one of those people who...
Yeah.
I love the character Rey. Daisy Ridley is amazing in that role. But the direction they're taking the character is sort of what worries me.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think, you know, my basic theory is she's a clone. She's probably cloned from Luke, or something that, you know, they kept from Luke.
Yeah.
Or something of the Skywalker bloodline, for their force sensitivity. And Skywalker is just going to be the name of what inherits a lot of what a Jedi was, but kind of evolves it a bit further. So, you know, Rise of the Skywalker is just, you know, and I feel like that's something that's, I feel like we've kind of, for the most part, at least perspectives I've seen, we've kind of all relatively guessed that conclusion, that it's going to be some kind of evolution of a Jedi type thing. At least that's my interpretation of it.
It could be. I mean, you're not, have that. Exactly. That is one of the popular theories. And the name, the title, we haven't really, until you, now that you mentioned it, discussed the name of Episode 9. And that would suggest that they're trying to wrap the whole thing up with it all being a Skywalker story.
But the question Skywalker is, going like, from, I guess, a person to an idea. Yeah.
Or, maybe, you know, it could all be Ben Solo's story. He could be the Skywalker.
Couldn't it just be Yoda's story, though? I mean, why are we, you know, couldn't these just be the 9 Yoda sagas?
I feel
hurt that it's not.
I love Yoda, but that would, that would not make, well, I mean,
who knows?
It's all about delivery. It's all about delivery.
No. But, I got a good question for you.
Yeah.
Young Yoda, was he tall? I mean, I know what the canon answer is, but in your mind, was he tall?
Was he tall? He was probably taller, but his species is pretty short, right?
It's supposed to be. But come on, when you were young and you were watching these movies, did you just think he was really small because he just got really, really, really old?
Oh, you know what? I don't even think I ever thought about it.
I think that was always my theory.
Like, what is 9? What is young when you're like 900 years old?
I know, right?
Well, is that when you're like in your 400s? I mean, but yeah, I never really thought of it. It kind of makes sense, though. That he would have been like, he's like pruned so much throughout his life. Yeah, well, it's like a raisin, but at 900, maybe he was like normal height, but he just shrinks.
That's what I like to think. I think
he's dehydrated. That's basically it. Yeah.
He eventually grew to like 6 feet tall, and then you know, people, they just keep getting smaller as they get older, and that's just what happened to Yoda. That's my like headcanon.
That makes sense. You know, there's another one of his species in the movies. There are only 2 known.
I don't remember them. Which one do they pop up in?
So she's part of the Jedi Council. Her name's Yaddle.
Oh, I kind of feel like I vaguely do remember this in like episode 2 or 3 or whatever.
Oddly enough, his species is only known as Yoda's species or something like that.
I love that.
Haven't really, it's just a shroud of mystery. There's no like Yoda planet that people know of, at least.
I'm all about that. I love those things where they leave so much room for you to kind of like interpret it. Do you feel like, to wrap it back to Evil Life, do you feel like knowing what you know about this story, do you feel like we close most of the loops here, or do we have some open stuff like that where people can kind of fill in the blanks?
I think we I think we close. I mean, we just discussed the pink goo monster. That's one of the open parts of the story. That doesn't get resolved, and it doesn't have to get resolved either. It's just like one of those weird background things. But in terms of written story, I think we close a lot of the. I mean, this is sort of the start of the story, really. If you think about how it ends,
it really is. It's crazy to think that there's so we've worked on it so much.
Yeah,
but this is this would be the first, movie. What we've done already, at least.
Oh yeah, this is the beginning. This is like the origin story.
Yeah.
Like one long origin story.
Yeah, it is one long origin story. Yeah. Still origining.
Yes.
As we speak.
Yes. Speaking of orange, what's funny with the way with the order of the chapters is that Gloom in his astral plane is actually wearing his actual Gloom outfit in the astral plane, but we haven't seen him in that outfit yet in the story, because he's in his lab coat, he's in his prince attire, but he's never in his actual super villain armored costume.
That's funny. I've gotten so deep into our story and these characters that I noticed that when you first drew it, completely forgot that now. And so when you said that, I was like, whoa, he is in my head. I don't think we're going to see that costume for a bit still.
Yeah, for a while.
Certainly not. I'm getting ready. You're going to see him next in, I think, chapter 9? Yes.
Yeah,
and
I think...
next in chapter 9, which
I think I know which one that is.
And no, you won't see it there. And you're not going to see it when he pops up again in what will presumably be... No, not in the next time you see him, which I'm not going to give away because it's a fun little guest appearance. And then you're not going to see it again in chapter 12 or 13, whenever his next chapter is after that.
But
no, wait,
it still kind of makes
no, you won't.
But it still kind of makes sense that he's in his head, in his mind, his astral form is dressed as his most true self, which is his armor and his cape and
it's
all
good.
That stuff.
And that's maybe one of our benefits of having told the story out of linear sequence when we were creating it, is that we got a chance to go back and add in little things like that. And that's something that I try to remember whenever it comes down to put the final text on these things, is like, okay, well, at least I know where we're going up through, panel 400, chapter 24 or whatever we're calling them. And I can at least seed a few things. And one of the things I'm very proud of that we did not intend to seed is that the beginning of this story and the end of this story, the end of this fulfills something that we introduced in the very beginning of it. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's been really fun to have the opportunity to go back and have those things. And I love that you did that with Prince Gloom and the astral plane, because I didn't even put two and two together. We were getting a preview of his final form.
I mean, it's probably unintentional, because when I think Gloom, I think that outfit, because it wasn't the first time. The first time I drew him, he wasn't wearing it. We had it in a concept sketch, but the first chapter we drew with him, he wasn't wearing maybe towards the end of that chapter, but not the first few panels at least. But that's still to me his truest form. That's when he's himself.